Welcome to the Maria Heller Show, the internet's original podcast. Since the year 2000, always ahead of the curve, always on your side. A true warrior for truth and justice, Maria and her guests leave nothing out, and no one is off limits. There is only one truth, the rest is lies. Sit back, enjoy the education with a true daughter of Mother Earth. Sharp New York wit, spiritual knowing, and a very dry sense of humor, Maria will dissect the news and lies to make it all palatable. Education is power. Maria delivers rapid-fire truth like no one else can. Here she is, the mouth that roars, the legendary Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria Heller here, alive and kicking. Good to be back. Welcome to Roaring Truth with myself and my co-host, Jim Fetzer. Today is November 22nd, and even though I unfortunately can see how many young people don't know what today represents, it was, in my estimation, the beginning of the end for America when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. And I don't know anybody who's done more work on this assassination than Jim Fetzer. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Maria. Yes. A melancholy occasion indeed, where I participated in a conference in Dallas this past weekend, which was organized by Judith Berry Baker, who had been Lee Oswald's girlfriend in New Orleans the summer before he came to Dallas and was framed for the assassination.
Right. Well, you know, for my listeners, I just want to make you aware, I've put up my interviews with Judith Berry Baker and so many other people on some of the best coverage out there, some of the best books. The whole front page is just loaded with that, and that's my way of honoring a president that I wish to God would have been able to live out his term.
Yes, you know, and it's fascinating to me, Maria, that the media now needs a scapegoat for getting the election so wrong. They have published so much fake news, they're looking for fall guys. And in the case of JFK, we have a stunning illustration where they've been publishing fake news about his assassination for 53 years.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's all we've gotten. And then anybody that investigated it is a conspiracy freak.
That's right. Where the CIA, of course, introduced that phrase conspiracy theorist or conspiracy theorist in order to undermine the critics of the Warren Commission, who were simply pointing out the gigantic holes in the case that made it impossible to believe what they had concluded, where they sought to shift attention from the falsification of the Warren report to place a burden of proof on those who were its critics by implying that if they didn't know every aspect, every detail of the assassination and exactly what had happened, they should not be taken seriously. Well, my own work has been dedicated from taking conspiracy theories in the weak sense of speculations, rumors, or guesses to conspiracy theories in the strong sense of empirically testable explanatory hypotheses, and where from the beginning, Maria, I brought together experts on different aspects of the case where I myself was not expert, including a world authority on the human brain who was also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics who was also board certified in radiation oncology, and was therefore an expert on the interpretation of x-rays, a physician who was actually in trauma room number one when JFK's moribund body was brought in. He was the last physician to observe the body. He closed JFK's eyes as they wrapped him in sheets and put a towel over his head into a bronze ceremonial casket, and others, which I believe is why the books that I have edited on this subject and others have been so powerful. It's a whole constellation, a convergence of research by independent investigators establishing the conclusions. In this case, for example, that JFK had been hit at least four times. David W. Mandick, the world authority, leading expert on the medical evidence in the assassination, believes that in addition to the shot to the back, which hit him about 5.5 inches below the collar just to the right of the spinal column, the shot to the throat, which actually passed through the windshield en route to its target, And after the driver, William Greer, brought the limousine to a halt in Dealey Plaza, two shots to the head, one to the back of the head fired from the Dow Tex, where he slumped forward. Jackie eased him back up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple area by a frangible exploding bullet that set up shockwaves, blowing his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium. So when they impacted with Officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot, but where David believes there may have been yet a third shot to the head. So it's vitally important that we retain the true history of the assassination, which led me to chair or co-chair five national conferences, Maria, and to publish three collections of expert studies, Assassination Science 1998, Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax 2003, which are widely regarded as having shattered the cover-up and exposed the conspiracy beneath it.
Right. You know, I was reading an article this morning that said as a result of Kennedy's assassination, that's when the 25th Amendment was passed, because they had nothing in place about who replaces the president. If in the case of, you know, an assassination or resignation, or if he gets removed from office. And at that time, I did not know this. The only two people that could step in was somebody who was like 74 and the other person was like 86.
Yeah, you're talking about the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, and then the President Pro Tem of the Senate. Yeah, they've now regularized this order of secession, which goes from the President to the Vice President to the Speaker of the House. Actually, the Secretary of State may be third in line. But Maria, it's really a fascinating situation, because at the time, it wasn't even a federal crime to assassinate the President. It was only a local crime, murder in this instance, where the body had to remain in Dallas in order to undergo an autopsy by law, but where the Secret Service forcibly removed the body from Dallas, put it on Air Force One in a bronze ceremonial casket, and where it appears while Lyndon Johnson was being sworn in, everyone was called forward. They took the body out of the casket, put it in a body bag, and secreted it in a compartment in the plane so that when they landed at Andrews Air Force Base and everyone was focusing on Jackie and Bobby and the casket being removed from the left side of the plane, the body itself was actually being removed from the right and loaded into a helicopter, where it was flown to Walter Reed, where the best forensic pathologists in the military removed metal fragments from his body, leaving a few, and then it was delivered in a black hearse in a pinkish-gray shipping casket inside a body bag to the back of the morgue at Bethesda, so that when Gerald Custer, who was the x-ray technician who was taking x-rays of the body, was headed upstairs in the company of two Secret Service men, he looked out the window and saw this enormous entourage accompanying the gray ambulance in which Jackie Kennedy had been brought to Bethesda, and asked himself, what in the world's going on? Because the body was already undergoing autopsy.
Right. And if it was, you know, considered a murder at the time, the body never really should have been moved out of Dallas.
That's exactly right. They actually brandished weapons to override the Justice of the Peace, Theron Ward, against his adamant opposition. They just took the body, because that was an essential part of the cover-up. They had to get the body under military control. Having these pathologists remove the metal fragments. Believe it or not, Maria, after they took the body in the black hearse to the back of Bethesda, the naval officer in command of the autopsy, who'd never performed a gunshot victim before in his life, took a cranial saw to the skull of JFK and enlarged the wound to make it look more like something that might have occurred from a shot from behind. He also appears to have enlarged the throat wound, which just a clear puncture wound, absolutely clean, obviously a wound of entry, and distorted it to make it, again, look more like something that might have been an exit wound. It was very messy, very nasty, but in fact, there were witnesses present when he performed the the removal or enlargement of the wound to the skull, including Thomas Evan Robinson, who would be the mortician who would prepare the body for the state funeral, which would be held on Monday the 25th, the same day that the vehicle was sent back to Ford Motor Company, be completely stripped down and rebuilt, including replacing the windshield with a through-and-through bullet hole. And because Thomas Evan Robinson had witnessed this, when, in the wake of the spectacular film JFK by Oliver Stone, the resurgence of interest led to Congress passing a JFK Records Act, creating a panel of five civilians who were entrusted to declassify documents and records from the CIA, the Secret Service, the FBI, and so forth, where only the president could override them, which George Herbert Walker Bush, then president, adamantly opposed, but it passed anyway. But he refused to appoint the members, which caused an 18-month delay until the Clinton administration, that's Bill Clinton, of course, could get into place and appoint the members. But when they did depositions and they finally got to Thomas Evan Robinson and asked him about these dotted lines on a diagram of the skull that had been drawn by a fellow named Boswell who was assisting Humes, he explained, oh, no, he said, the doctors did that. So they had transformed a fist-sized hole at the back of the head to enormous dimensions. In fact, David Lifton, who was the first to realize the enormity of what was going on here, read a description from the autopsy report of the dimensions of this wound to an expert without identifying the patient and asked him what that sounded like. And they said it sounded like he'd been hit in the head with an axe. I mean, it was that enormous, Maria.
Right.
And eventually, when the House Select Committee on Assassination would investigate the case in 1976-77, issuing their final report in 1979, they contracted the wound. They filled it all in. There's not only the fist size, there's not the monster gaping hole, right, to a little hole right at the top of the head. I think they were trying to redo the cover-up in a more adequate fashion than had been done in the original case by the Warren Commission.
Right. Let me ask you this about the conference. Was there anything new? I mean, you know, as we continue to go along, there always seems to be something else that we find out or we uncover. And I'm assuming, were you there as a speaker or were you there in attendance?
Both, all of the above, yeah. The most important new evidence occurred at the beginning and at the end of the conference because Larry Rivera, who is a part of the new JFK show team consisting of Gary King, Don Fox, Larry Rivera, and myself, where we have a one-hour program every Wednesday is the second hour of The Real Deal, had been working for some time on the identity of the man in the doorway, where many students had believed that in this very famous photograph taken by AP photographer James Ike Alchin, you see a figure peering out who looks very much like he might be Lee Oswald. Ralph Sinquet, a couple of years ago, wrote me to say that the key to the identification was the height, the weight, the body build, the shirt, and the T-shirt. And on the basis of a great deal of research, we determined without any doubt that the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, and the T-shirt fit Lee Oswald, not Billy Lovelady, a co-worker who was alleged to have been the man in the doorway. He turns out to have actually been in the doorway, but he's not the man peering out who was, in fact, Lee Oswald, as I'm going to explain. Billy said he always thought it was odd because he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 20 to 30 pounds heavier than Lee. Not only that, but he was wearing a red and white vertically striped short sleeve shirt, whereas the man in the doorway is wearing a long sleeve, richly textured shirt. Because Billy had actually gone to the FBI on the 29th of February, 1964, and been photographed wearing the shirt he had been wearing on that occasion. We had long since been able to establish that it had to have been Lee Oswald, but the facial features were just obscure enough that people, you know, some of those who were opposed to this revelation and where I once had a conversation with Gordon Duff, when as senior editor of Veterans Today, when I was still publishing with him, I said, Gordon, I think half of those in the JFK research community are working the other side. He said, no, Jim, he said, it's 90. And so there had been a lot of opposition to this finding. What Gary did was to find suitable photographs of both Billy Lovelady and of Lee Oswald of their face. And he did photogrammetric, very mathematical, very precise mapping of their facial features, comparison of their nose, the distance between the pupils of their eyes, their ears, and so forth, and was able to create GIFs in which you see their face entering into the photograph, what we see there is somewhat obscure, and it turns out that Lee Oswald's features fit the face exactly, and Billy Lovelady's do not. And then when you turn to the man standing beside him with his arms raised, protecting his eyes from the sun, who we have long believed to be Billy Lovelady, he did a similar analysis with such features as you can find in the photograph, and it's an exact fit for Billy Lovelady. So we have now decisively settled the issue of whether Lee Oswald was in fact in the doorway. Harold Weisberg had believed it as he published in Photographic Whitewash back in 1966. Jim Garrison, who had brought the prosecution against Gay Shaw, had believed that it was Lee in the doorway. We now have a stunning, technically sophisticated, scientifically impeccable study that demonstrates that to be the case, which means, of course, not only can Lee have not have been the lone demented gunman, he cannot have been one of the shooters either.
Right, right. Well, you know, today, because people learn so little, and history, you know, some people have said history is a waste of time to teach people in school, a lot of young people really don't even have any clue about what happened to JFK, as if it's not important. What would you say to somebody who said, Jim, all these years later, why is it important to understand the assassination?
Well, without any doubt, it altered American history. JFK was threatening to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He had not invaded Cuba. He had signed an above-ground test ban treaty and was pulling our troops out of Vietnam, which antagonized the Joint Chiefs and caused them to throw in with taking him out. The anti-Castro Cubans were upset because they believed falsely that he'd betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. The mafia was upset because Bobby was cracking down on organized crime and bringing more indictments and convictions ever in history. In fact, just as J. Edgar had sex dossiers on the members of Congress that enabled him to manipulate them, the mob had one on J. Edgar, including compromising photographs of him with his close personal assistant, Clyde Tolson, so that Edgar was not able to even acknowledge the existence of organized crime until much later, when they were detailed by one of the capos of the Cosa Nostra in such a precise fashion, it was no longer possible to deny it. The Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed were upset because Jack had already instructed the Department of the Treasury to print hundreds of millions of dollars in United States notes in the belief that it was absurd for the government to be paying interest to a consortium of private banks in order to print the currency of the United States. The Texas oil men were upset because he was going to cut their oil depletion allowance. Israel was upset because he was at loggerheads with David Ben-Gurion over Ben-Gurion's desire that Israel should develop its own nuclear weapons, which Jack opposed. They all threw in as sponsors of the assassination. The key facilitators were Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover themselves. Lyndon in orchestrating the assassination, Edgar in covering it up using the FBI as the instrument. For example, the 10 witnesses closest to the limousine were never called by the FBI. They were never interrogated. Those who were close weren't asked the important questions that would have elicited information, for example, about the limo stop. Others who actually gave information that was important had their testimony altered by the Warren Commission, and it was stunning. Lyndon had forced himself on the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960. He was on neither Jack or Bobby's long list, much less their short. Right. Jack Jack had already extended an invitation to Stuart Symington of Missouri to be his running mate when Bobby went by the Johnson suite. He was astonished when Lyndon jumped on the alternative. Neither Bobby nor Jack had ever imagined he'd give up his position as a powerful majority leader of the Senate. Instead, Johnson manipulated the situation, explaining that if he weren't on the ticket, he'd reveal that JFK had Addison's disease and wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life, that he'd had dalliances with beautiful women, some of whom were spies for East Germany, and that if he were not on the ticket, then any legislative proposals coming down from the White House would be dead on arrival, because as a majority leader, he'd bottle them up. Jack and Bobby couldn't figure a way out of it, and for the only time in his life, Jack had to rescind a political decision. When one of Johnson's very wealthy backers burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing because he was going to run to help JFK become elected, Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later state publicly that JFK would not survive his term in office and he'd die a violent death. And in fact, Lyndon Johnson, we now know, sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements for the assassination were in place.
Well, it was the worst death blow to America. You know, when you talk about how they didn't interview the witnesses, the ones that they did, how they, you know, changed their stories. You know, my mind immediately went to September 11, 2001. When the FBI basically did the same thing to witnesses, pretty much trying to convince them they didn't see what they actually saw.
Yes. Well, in relation to, you know, JFK's specific policies, like pulling out of Vietnam, like circumventing the Fed, the United States publishing its own money, the oil depletion allowance, with a succession of Lyndon Johnson, all those went by the board. Israel was even allowed to develop nuclear weapons. We had a series of presidents who would never have held that office but for the death of JFK, including Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, George H.W. Bush, where the assassination attempt on Reagan was basically a message, let George do it. And then, of course, his son W., who had never been taken seriously for the office, had his father not previously held it. In fact, the Bush family represents a crime cabal of immense proportions that seems to be rivaled only by the more recent Clinton crime family, where, you know, we now have a list of over 186 deaths of close associates, people who knew too much in relation to the Clinton Foundation. George H.W. Bush appears to have organized the Bay of Pigs invasion. It was codenamed Zapata, which was the name of the oil company, family oil company. He rechristened two of the ships, Barbara and Houston, just before the event. And indeed, in Dallas, we have a photograph I discovered of him standing in front of the Texas School Book Depository. He was, in fact, arrested coming out of the Dow Tex, from which three shots were fired by an anti-Castro Cuban named Nestor Tony Escadro, using a Mannlicher Carcano. These were the only unsilenced rounds that were fired, where he had two misses. One hit a distant curbing and injured a bystander by the name of James Tague. Another missed JFK and hit the chrome strip above the windshield, but where the third hit him in the back of the head during that limo stop I previously cited. Bush was taken down to be questioned, but then released with no records kept. He went back to Dealey Plaza. We have photographs of W., who was there with him, looking a bit lost because he didn't know the location of his father. But we have other photographs of Edward Lansdale, who appears to have was responsible for assassinations all over the world, and who appears to have determined the specific locations and the specific shots that were taken by each of the shooters, where I've identified six of them, and there may have been a seventh. Their locations, the shots they took, and the effects they had. We have a photograph of Lansdale walking past the so-called three tramps, who were actually found in a boxcar that was loaded with ammo explosives. and weapons, whom I believe were the backup fall guys, the backup patsies, if Lee Oswald hadn't played out. Lansdale's walking past them. He's been identified by no less authorities than Fletcher Prouty and Victor Krulak, among the most celebrated of all Marine Corps generals. So we have a third photograph where Lansdale is waiting patiently to speak to George Herbert Walker Bush. So there you have the principals right there in Dealey Plaza at the time. Lyndon was in overall charge, but of course he delegated. I mean, that would all be done in terms of the detail principally by the CIA, but one of the shooters was on the top of the county records building. A Dallas deputy sheriff firing a .30-06 to implant a Mannlicher Carcano bullet in the back of JFK using a plastic collar known as a sabot. The shooter under the triple underpass fired a shot through the windshield. We have a through-and-through hole in the windshield that hit JFK in the throat. That appears to have been Jack Lawrence, who was an Air Force expert who went to work for the car dealership that provided the vehicles for the motorcade. They were unusually all different makes, models, and colors, so the culprits could know exactly who was where. Jack's personal military aide was moved to the very last vehicle, as was his personal physician. If the aide had been sitting between Greer, the driver, and Kellerman, the agent in charge, he would have been hit by that bullet that hit Jack in the throat, so they had to move him. Then I've mentioned already the anti-Castro Cuban. Another shot was fired from the grassy knoll by a Dallas police officer with ties to the CIA by the name of Roscoe White. Jim Mars and I had co-authored an article about framing the patsy, the faking of the backyard photographs, where Lee's holding a Mannlicher Carcano, two communist newspapers, in a holster with a revolver with which he's alleged to have shot Officer Tippett, in which because the chin isn't Lee's chin, we believe, in fact, the stand-in for Lee Oswald was the one and the same Roscoe White, who was on the grassy knoll and fired a shot, but apparently pulled his shot. They were under strict instructions that Jackie should not be harmed. So he pulled his shot, and the bullet was found in the grass opposite the grassy knoll. The shot that hit JFK in the right temple came from the intersection of the triple underpass and the grassy knoll, was fired by Frank Sturgis, who was a kind of a soldier of fortune and may have been the best shot in the world at the time. He was arrested in New York going to murder Marita Lorenz, who had been a mistress of Fidel, knew a great deal about the assassination. Before she could testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations by New York Gold Shield detective Jim Rothstein, who put a gun to his head, took him into custody, and gave him the throwaway line, "Nice shooting," at which point Sturgis admitted that he had been aiming for his eye, but he moved slightly, so he hit him in the temple instead, and that he was willing to assassinate the president because he betrayed the brigade at the Bay of Pigs and because he'd cavorted with beautiful women, some of whom were East German spies. Other shots were fired from the book depository, none from the sixth floor window where the assassin's lair was alleged to be located. The beauty of having three shots fired from the Dow Tex with an unsilenced weapon is acoustically, it would be extremely difficult to discriminate between shots that were fired from the sixth floor of the book depository and shots that were fired from the Dow Tex. Instead, on the opposite side, Maria, was Malcolm Mack Wallace, LBJ's personal hitman, who murdered at least a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters, firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough, who was a liberal Texas senator LBJ despised. He'd had a huge argument with JFK that morning, trying to get Connally out and Yarborough in. But Jack overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States, and it was too late to get the word to the shooters. Because Connally was shot and because he was so tight with Lyndon, no one would have ever believed that he would have allowed his crony to be put in such jeopardy. You can see that he has a grim visage prior to the motorcade, Maria, but Connally knew just as much about what was going on as did Lyndon.
Right, but you know, when it's amazing how many of them change their stories, do you know what I mean, from the beginning to the end. In the article you sent me this morning, I did not know about this, so I think it's important. You talk about the CIA dispatch number 1035-960, which was handed out in 1967, but without a Freedom of Information Act in 1976, none of us would know about it. What is that dispatch from the CIA?
It's a dispatch about how to deal with critics of the Warren Commission. I included it as well as the original Bethesda autopsy report in among the appendices in my first collection on JFK assassination science in 1998. It suggests you're supposed to reply to them by suggesting that they have nothing new to offer, that they are financially interested, that they're seeking to gain attention, a series of flimsy reasons. And this was the occasion on which the phrase conspiracy theory or conspiracy theorist was introduced in this very memorandum. And as I have explained already, it was intended to shift the burden of proof onto the critics, who actually were successfully falsifying the evidence that had been used to implicate Lee Oswald, including those backyard photographs, where not only is there an insert line between the chin, which is a blocked chin, not Lee's more pointed chin, and the lower lip, but where the face is exactly the same across four or five different photographs, all taken at different times and poses, which is an optical impossibility. When Lee had been shown one of these by Will Fritz during his interrogation, he said that was his face pasted on someone else's body, that he knew something about photography, and with time he'd be able to prove it. Well, we have long since proved it many times over, and that the Mannlicher Carcano was a piece of junk. In fact, it was known in World War II as the humanitarian rifle for never harming anyone on purpose. It was rusty. It had a very difficult bolt action. It had a kind of a two-stage hair trigger. Its sight was misaligned. In fact, professional marksmen were asked to use the weapon to test it to see if it was possible to fire that many shots in the amount of time that were allocated for them in relation to the revised Zapruder film, which dramatically reduced the time frame by removing so many other frames from the film, refused to do it until it was completely rebuilt. Jesse Ventura and I did a JFK hour that's just wonderful, where Jesse invited me, flew me out to California to set up a reconstruction of the shooting with a far superior Mannlicher Carcano.
Jim, I think I might have lost him. All right, we're going to take a short break here, and I'll be right back.
She's been called Paula Revere, the mother of the internet and even a legend. The mouth that roars, roars all truth without any input from corporate, religious, or political affiliations. Rhea's in it just like you are. Often imitated but never duplicated. Commercial-free talk providing a real education in a world filled with lies, cover-ups, and propaganda. Subscribe now and encourage your friends to do the same. Feel good about supporting real media that supports you and all life on this planet. Pick a subscription of your choice and get started on the journey down the rabbit hole. If you are financially challenged or a senior on a limited income, please send an email to maria@maria.net and she will work something out for you. There's never been a more dangerous or exciting time to be alive. Education is a necessity now. Stay informed. Subscribe today at www.meria.net.
Okay, welcome back to Roaring Truth with my co-host Jim Fetzer. Jim, before we got, as usual, it only happens with you, cut off the air on a JFK show, you were talking about what you did with Jesse Ventura.
Right, exactly.
Trying to recreate Jesse, that shooting scene.
Jesse flew me out to Ventura, California to set up, to make sure that his attempted reconstruction with a far superior Mannlicher Carcano, where Jesse's a far superior shot, where we use bales of hay to represent the distance and location and angle of the limousine when the three shots were allegedly made by Lee Oswald. And suggests he went through multiple attempts to replicate the shooting, which according to the official account took place in like about 6.5 seconds, which of course was an artifact from editing the film and trying to, you know, create a fanciful scenario to market to the public. I timed each of the shot sequences with a stopwatch, and he couldn't get anywhere near to that amount of time in firing the shots. They were most around 10, 11, 12 seconds. In fact, in all the replications, Jesse only managed to hit one of the targets one time. In other words, it's really preposterous, which is reinforced by the fact that Carlos Hathcock, who was the leading sniper in the Marine Corps at the time, had attempted a reconstruction, had been unsuccessful, and quite reasonably inferred that if he, the best shot in the Marine Corps, had been unable to replicate the shooting, then Lee Oswald, who was a mediocre shot at best, certainly could not have done it. And that is some of the, you know, earliest evidence we have. We started talking about the conference, and I should add that at the end of the conference, I made a presentation on lines of proof we have about the alteration of the Zapruder film, which some still believe to this day is the closest thing we have to absolute truth about the assassination. Zapruder said he started filming when the motorcade came from Houston, started to turn onto Elm, and then until it disappeared under the Triple Underpass. But there's a huge gap there right at the beginning. So the motorcade comes up to Elm Street, and then boom, all of a sudden you see it in front of the Stemmons freeway sign. That is because the Greer swung out too widely, apparently mistaking a frontage road in front of the book depository for Elm Street, and he nearly hit a concrete abutment there. He even paused momentarily, getting the vehicle back online. But more significantly is, further down Elm Street, he actually pulled the limousine to the left and to an abrupt halt, which actually threw the passengers forward. Oddly enough, apparently concerned that some witnesses would remember they're being jostled forward. They use that footage of them being jostled forward as part of an acceleration scene after frame 313. So it's very, very curious how it was done. I mentioned the two shots. They merged the two shots into what was supposed to be one, but there's still the forward movement from the shot that hit JFK in the back of the head. And then there's this violent back and to the left. What actually happened, Maria, is he just slumped to the left while Jackie climbed down the trunk going after a big chunk of JFK's skull and brains. But when they merged the two shots, they took out too many frames, so you had this violent back and to the left, which was not witnessed by anyone in Dealey Plaza. It didn't happen. It's just an artifact of the way they edited. Yeah. Most importantly, however, is that we now have transcripts of interviews that were done with all four of the motorcycle escort officers and their supervisor, Stavis Ellis, where that were conducted under the supervision of Fred Newcomb, who was a first-generation investigator. Larry Rivera, once again, did brilliant work in transcribing them, and it turns out all four of the motorcycle officers confirmed the limo stop. Not only that, but after Hargis was hit by the brains and debris so hard he thought he himself had been shot, he parked his bike and dismounted and ran in between the two limousines, which of course would have been impossible if they had not been stationary, toward the grassy nowhere from which he believed the shot had been fired. Officer Jackson, riding on the right, actually motored up the grassy knoll until his bike fell over and then proceeded on foot. Meanwhile, five Secret Service agents dismounted from the Secret Service limousine and surrounded the presidential. One of them took a piece of skull from a little boy and threw it in the back seat. Meanwhile, Clint Hill is rushing up to push Jackie back and then lay across her body, where he observes this gaping fist-sized hole in the back of JFK. Turns to his colleagues and gives them a thumbs down. Well, all of this was so incredibly incriminating of the Secret Service, for whom we have over 15 indications of them having set up JFK for the hit, that they had to take it out. In his book, 6 Seconds of Dallas, Josiah Thompson gives a very scientific study of the motion of the head and the back motion. I don't believe he did it himself, but it was by far the best part of his book. which he began disavowing sometime in advance of the 50th. I was convinced that by the 50th he was going to disavow conspiracy and the assassination of JFK as a kind of a political stunt. He started to do what were going to be a whole series of short interviews with a very famous filmmaker. I think there would have been as many as 60. But after the very first one, which had to do with Umbrella Man, who's there pumping his umbrella up and down as a signal to the shooters that he's still alive, so keep shooting, and this the so-called Cuban reaches out and gives his fist gesture as a command to stop, and Greer pulls it over and they stop. He tries to explain it all away, but I published an article about it just dismembering his account and what he'd done here, so they discontinued the planned series of interviews. It's in an article entitled JFK, the CIA, and the New York Times, where you can find it. But meanwhile, David Lifton had taken a series of photographs of the frames to Richard Feynman, who was at the time the world's most famous physicist at Caltech. And Feynman took a ruler and was able himself to establish that JFK's head was going forward from frame 312 to 313 and then back and to the left, so that Lifton, through Feynman, had independently corroborated the double hits. We had, by the way, as we know of six or eight persons who have actually seen what appears to be the unedited film, and they all confirm the limo stop and the double hits. So this is a matter of getting the proof out there on the table. Right. And during this final presentation, I presented all of this, which really leaves no doubt at all about the massive editing of the film. Where the original was taken, Maria, to the National Photographic Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C. on Saturday the 23rd. It was an 8mm already split film that had been developed in Dallas. They had to have a shop owner open his store to buy an 8mm projector so they could play it. Meanwhile, the film was being revised at a secret CIA lab in Rochester adjacent to Kodak headquarters called Hawkeye Works. And a man who identified himself as William Smith brought a 16mm unsplit film to the National Photographic Interpretation on Sunday, the 24th, and the substitution was made at that point in time.
Now, wasn't there also a second film, filmed by someone else, that we've never seen? I mean, I find it hard to believe. Everybody was into their, Bell and Howell cameras in those days.
There were eight different films that captured part of the motorcade, the two most important of which, however, are the Zapruder film and, taken from the opposite side, the Nix film. Yeah, what's interesting about the Nix film is that, among the other features, although they used the Zapruder as a guide to modifying the other films, including the Nix, they weren't quite successful, because in the next film you can see Jackie going further out on the trunk than in the Zapruder. So the films are not consistent from film to film, but even within the Zapruder film it isn't internally consistent, because they spent a lot of time blacking out the blowout at the back of his head in the early frames from 314, 15, 16, 17. But it occurred to me that they were so focused on blacking out the hole they might have overlooked that it might be visible in later frames. And in frame 374, I actually discovered you can see the blowout to the back of the head, which means the film isn't even internally consistent. In fact, a group of Hollywood film restoration experts have been looking at a very high-quality version of the Zapruder film they obtained from the National Archives, which is known as the forensic copy because its quality is so good. I've seen the film they have in their studio in Los Angeles. It's extremely good, and they were all appalled by the crudity with which the black hole in the back of the head had been blacked out. So we also have studies. John P. Costella did a brilliant tutorial about internal features of the Zapruder film, which he regarded as about 98% technically perfect. What the other 2% were giveaways, including the location of the Stemmen sign. He has a series showing where the sign was located and then where it was placed in the film, and it's very, very different. So I presented that, as well as showing the film repeatedly and talking about some of the obvious features of how we knew that something was terribly wrong with the film from the beginning.
Right. Well, you think about that movie, Conspiracy Theory, with Mel Gibson. which probably has one of the worst beatings in it I've ever seen in my life, what they do to Mel Gibson's character when they catch him.
Oh, the torture. Yeah, the torture scene.
Right. But here he is, you know, he's a little guy, you know, they're trying to say he's crazy, you know, he's got a newsletter that's got like 5 subscribers, and he talks about conspiracy. And of course, you know, I think the film was to make conspiracy theory people look crazy, although I agreed pretty much with everything Mel Gibson said in that movie. But at the end, it's when Julia Roberts' character ask Mel Gibson's character if he could prove any of his theories. He said something that I think is pretty huge. He said, no, a good conspiracy is an unprovable one. If you can prove it, they must have screwed up somewhere along the line.
Well, the fact is, conspiracy is the most widely prosecuted crime in the United States. It just involves 2 or more individuals collaborate to perform an illegal act. So conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit burglary, conspiracy to commit robbery. These are very common. The idea of introducing that phrase conspiracy theory and trying to draw it out Mel Gibson was articulate so that a conspiracy theory is supposed to have no evidence. Turns out to be, you know, just an artificial construction to try to undermine the idea of conspiracy theories. Because as all my research in this area has been devoted to taking conspiracy theories out of the room of rumor, speculation, and guesswork, into the domain of empirically testable scientific hypotheses. So we've been able to scientifically, objectively establish the autopsy x-rays were altered to conceal the blowout to the back of the head. Scientifically establish that the diagrams and photographs of a brain in the National Archives are not of the brain of JFK. Scientifically and objectively establish that the Zapruder film is a massively revised and edited. Scientifically and objectively establish that Lee Oswald was in the doorway while the motorcade went past. We have been doing the scientific work. In fact, even Vincent Bugliosi, who published a 1,500-page magnum opus for which I believe he was paid in excess of $1 million to prove the Warren Commission report was right, which, of course, is a futile exercise, acknowledged in his huge volume that mine were the only 3 exclusively scientific books ever published on the assassination.
Wow, that's a shockaroo coming out of him.
I know.
That's really like the shockaroo of the century. When, you know, you look at, you know, I mean, we've been alive a long time. All right, Jim. How do you imagine America would have been different had JFK lived?
Well, in the first place, you would have had no Vietnam War because he was going to end it. In fact, that was the first action of Lyndon Johnson was to rescind JFK's directive about pulling American advisors out of the war. The oil depletion allowance, a huge tax rate the oilmen got on the ground that they were putting themselves out of business by pumping oil out of the ground because it was a finite resource, would have been implemented. The Fed would have been abolished because Jack was going forward with a treasury bringing hundreds of millions. Israel would not have developed nuclear weapons. In fact, today, because Israel has a vast stockpile of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons that are undeclared, in relation to U.S. foreign policy, they're receiving foreign aid they're not entitled to receive because our foreign policy guidelines specifically state that no nation with undeclared weapons of mass destruction is, and you know, can receive U.S. foreign aid. So it's just conveniently ignored. JFK had the World Jewish Congress register as a foreign agent for all its lobbying work with Congress, but since his assassination, no one has had the nerve to require the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, they call themselves Public Affairs Committee, to register, even though they're the most powerful lobby in Washington. In fact, Cynthia McKinney relatively recently acknowledged that when a new member of Congress comes to Washington, D.C., they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States. And those who do not find themselves opposed by a well-financed candidate next time around, or that their district has been redrawn and they no longer have a seat, so that this massive influence of the Jewish lobby has to be brought to an end, but has been allowed to grow since the time of Lyndon Johnson. We've had these powerful forces in place that have continued to exert influence right up to this time, most obviously the CIA. I mean, William Colby explained to Congress that the CIA owns everyone of significance in the major media. Carl Bernstein had preceded him by publishing an article entitled The CIA and the Media in Rolling Stone in 1977, where he reported how high officials of the agency had boasted that their greatest successes had been with Time Life, with the New York Times, and with CBS. And in that interval, if you could have a lock on Time Life, New York Times, and CBS, you could pretty much control the news in America. Today, we found that the New York Times has become a prominent promulgator of false news. You know, the idea that Obama's talking about fake news, that just reflects so badly on the major media because they were feeding us all these phony stories about the campaign. Phony stories of attacks on Donald Trump, phony stories about, non-coverage of Hillary's involvement in Clinton Foundation and all that. But most importantly, the false reports about the polling indicating that Hillary had a lock and that Donald didn't have a chance. I mean, there's lots of fake news out there, Maria, but the most staggering cases have been of the reporting about false reports about the death of JFK and the further false reports about the events of 9/11, which were magnet examples of fake news.
Right, exactly. I know at the conference, I thought I read that Abraham Bolden was going to be there. Did you get to meet him?
Well, I'd actually interviewed Abraham Bolden, who was the first black Secret Service agent. Bolden is in very bad health, and he was presented with an award for his contributions to JFK research. He published a book entitled The Echo from Dealey Plaza.
Right.
But because of his poor health, he wasn't physically present. It was done. The award was presented, and a videotape of the presentation was shown.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I interviewed him too, and I have that one on my front page as well. You know, and he pretty much, you know, he had to pay a hard price for telling the truth. You know,
they locked him up
until, you know, their dirty deed was done.
Yeah, well, another striking aspect is that a book was published about the performance of the Secret Service in Dallas that day. It's actually, if it were accurate, appalling, because they left two agents behind at Love Field who would have ridden on the presidential limo or run beside it. They put all the limousines in the wrong order, so JFK was out front when he should have been in the middle, after the mayor and then the vice president. They canceled a flatbed truck that would have had reporters covering. They ordered a stand down on the 110th Military Intelligence Unit that would have distributed crowd control all through the city. The crowd was allowed to spill out 8, 10, 12 into the street. They didn't weld the manhole covers. They left the windows open and uncovered. They cut down the motorcycle escort to 4 and instructed them not to ride ahead of the rear wheels. You know, they were doing everything they could to set him up so he'd have no protection when he came into Dealey Plaza. The motorcade route was changed just 4 days in advance to do this detour off of Main into Houston onto Elm to slow down the vehicle without alarming the occupants. When they got to Parkland, one of the agents got a bucket of water and sponge and started washing the blood and brains out of the limousine. It's an appalling record, but get this. The book is entitled The Kennedy Detail, and there's a crystal clear, it talks about Clint Hill having lying across the body and seeing this open, gaping, fist-sized wound at the back of his head, which, of course, already is conclusive proof that the official account is false because that was from a shot fired from in front. Lee Oswald could have not have fired, and, of course, we know now he didn't fire anything, but it also refutes the authenticity of the Zapruder film because, you know, they blacked it out for most of the film.
And, you know, and that's the way they lead Americans around, by their nose, you know. And if anybody questions the official story, you know, you're the crazy one. You know, it shouldn't be up to us as the citizens to have to provide the evidence. The government should provide the evidence. Look how quickly they got rid of the evidence on 9/11. And Giuliani, the big part of it, and now, you know, he looks like he might be getting a big fat reward in this new administration. But every time I look at Giuliani, all I could think about is the horrors that he did on 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maria, let me hasten to add that I did a short video. It was in the wake of the BBC interviewing me about 9/11, and we had a nice long pre-interview, very good, which I recorded. And then when I actually was interviewed, they arranged it a way that I couldn't record it. They tried to attack my research on 9/11. But I took parts of the interview, the pre-interview, and turned it into a short video on YouTube entitled "Why I, Jim Fetzer, Am a Conspiracy Theorist." Oh. Runs about 17 minutes. And let me share with you that I'm very pleased to announce that I have a new show on the Gary Knowles Progressive Radio Network as Conspiracy Guy Wednesdays at 9 p.m. in New York City.
Wow, good for you. Yeah, Gary replaced my show. Actually, this show will be on Gary's show, hopefully this Sunday. They've been doing that for years. I always send them one show a week on Sunday at 3 in the afternoon in New York time. So congratulations to you, Jim. Well, that's pretty much all the time. That's pretty much all the time we have on this somber, freezing cold day in the mountains of Arizona.
Real pleasure talking with you, Maria. I'm glad we're continuing to do the shows.
Of course we will. We're human beings that know how to work out our differences, unlike the crazy people out there. Anyway, you take good care, Jim, and I'll talk with you soon.
Perfect, Maria. Thank you.
Take care. Jim Fetzer, check out his work. Jim's got a great blog, and his YouTube channel will keep you busy probably forever. And I will be back on Thursday. I have tons of news. If it gets to be too long, I may actually do some of it tomorrow. It just depends on what my schedule looks like. Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. Education is key. We've been led by the nose and lied to forever. And again, thanks again for supporting the show. I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.